for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The First Amendment guarantee of free speech is considered the crown jewel of our Constitution. For more than 50 years, attorney Floyd Abrams has litigated some of the nation's most high-profile First Amendment cases. In a new collection of his life's work, Abrams writes about his role in the Pentagon Papers, what he thinks about WikiLeaks, and his controversial stance in the Citizens United case. His book is titled Friend of the Court, On the Front Lines with the First Amendment. Floyd Abrams joins me in the studio. You are welcome to join us. 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. It's good to see you, sir.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So wonderful, after all these years, to have you here in the studio again. It would seem that this issue of the conflict between national security and First Amendment freedoms is a recurring one.
Right. Absolutely.
Now. Right now.
I mean, it's recurring through American history, but really, it would be hard to pick a time in which it was more relevant to more issues arising more often than right now.
Do you think that 9/11 has made it even more so?
Yes, in a few ways. One is 9/11 made very clear the magnitude of the danger that exists to us. At the same time, some of the reactions to 9/11 have made it all the more important that First Amendment rights and other constitutional rights be preserved and protected.
I think there are a great many people who want to ask you about your decision and your defense of Citizens United. Here's something posted on our website from Patty. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but she says, after Citizens United, someone like me, who lives on limited income, feels my speech is diminished. My $25 contributions seem almost worthless.
Look, I think we have a real problem and a continuing problem of equalization of wealth and equality of power in America. We've had it a long time, and we continue to have it. I don't think the way to address it is by limiting speech of people who have money or corporations or unions or the like. My view is you deal with economic problems in economic ways or legislative ways. Corporations have too much power. You can pass laws. You can tax them more. You can have more enforcement of antitrust laws. You can do a lot of things. And one thing that is very important to do is to have more disclosure of who's giving money. And the Citizens United case is on board for that. I mean, there was an 8-1 vote there upholding the disclosure requirements in the Citizens United case. As I view Citizens United, in the first instance, it's about on the facts of the case. It's about the right of a conservative political organization to put on a documentary blasting, trying to pulverize then-Senator Hillary Clinton when she was the leading Democratic candidate for president. Under the laws that then existed, that film, that documentary, and a very biased one it was, could not appear on television or on cable or on satellite within 60 days of an election or 30 days of a primary. I thought that was unconstitutional. I think the idea of saying that it's a crime to put on a documentary, whatever one thinks of it, attacking a candidate for president must violate the First Amendment. And my reasoning goes from there. So I think Citizens United is a good pro-First Amendment decision. And I think there are other things we can do to deal with the genuine feelings of Patty about the fact that her $25 seems to buy less in the way of communications now.
What kinds of reactions did you get after you successfully argued that case?
From my friends, unremittingly hostile. I grew to have a new bunch of friends, temporary political alliances on the right.
People were surprised that you took that case.
See, I think, I want to put it very candidly, I'm very surprised that so many of my liberal friends are willing to sacrifice First Amendment interests
and that's how
for their political liberalism. And that's what I think they're doing. I think that they are, for the first time maybe in their lives, diminishing their support for the First Amendment because of who is asserting it.
Did you foresee that 501c4s, which could indeed hide the identity of individuals who contributed, did you foresee that as an outcome in the ruling?
I don't believe that the ruling did cause, on any real meaning of causation, what we see now with the 501c4s. The 501c4s can do what they do because there is no legal obligation for them to reveal their sources of income. Congress can do that. Congress did it in the McCain-Feingold law. I mean, that's why what we call super PACs are ones that we know who gives money. That's why we know how much money Mr. Adelson gave. That's why we know everything about the contributions or the expenditures made as a direct result of Citizens United. So, you know, my answer is Congress is at fault for not having an across-the-board requirement of more disclosure. That's where I think the fault lies, not with a decision which said disclosure is constitutional, required disclosure is constitutional. Only Clarence Thomas, only one member of the court, voted against that proposition. All the others said not only that disclosure is constitutional, but that disclosure serves, in a way, First Amendment interests by informing the public.
But then those 501c4s referring to the Citizens United decision were able, because Congress did not do the work you said it should have done. Doesn't it, though, go back to Citizens United?
I'm afraid I think it goes back to the First Amendment. That where we go is the proposition that, we don't allow the government to tell people or organizations how much they can say or what they can say about who to vote for.
What do you say to Patty, who does talk about her $25 contribution and the voice the impact that has versus the corporate voice and the intent of lobbyists and corporations with a great deal of money and the voice they have?
I say really what I said earlier, that we've got a problem, and it's a growing problem, in terms of people with more money making more money,
so,
and other people making less and having less say. True, less say in everything, including the government. And I say the answer to that has got to be a political answer, not one which limits what would otherwise be First Amendment rights. I mean, it's got to be some sort of effective movement to empower the patties of the world without limiting speech. Speech is the last thing we should be limiting. I was in Ohio in the last week of the last campaign, and I understand that the folks in Ohio were sick of the ads. For me, it was a First Amendment paradise. I turned on television. All there are political ads. Well, political ads are good, not bad, from a First Amendment perspective. More speech about who to vote for is a good thing, not a bad thing. And to the extent that Citizens United has contributed, no pun intended, to that, I think it's a good thing. But look, in all candor, I would be in favor of the decision even if I thought the results of the decision were worse, because I think that the heart of the First Amendment is the protection of political speech.
Floyd Abrams, his new book is Friend of the Court, On the Front Lines with the First Amendment. And when we come back, I see the lines are filled. We'll talk more and take your calls. Stay with us. The First Amendment of our Constitution is often referred to as the crown jewel, and one of the most outspoken defenders of that First Amendment is here with me this morning, Floyd Abrams. He is a senior partner at Cahill, Gordon & Rendell. He is the author of a brand new book titled Friend of the Court, On the Front Lines with the First Amendment. Floyd Abrams, remind us of how this amendment became such an important one to our nation.
Well, in a sense, it was important from the start. The Constitution, of course, didn't have a Bill of Rights when it was initially drafted, but Thomas Jefferson in Paris, as our first ambassador, said he wouldn't support it without a Bill of Rights, that the public was entitled to it as a protection, he said, against the government. And the heart of what he was talking about was the First Amendment, protection, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of association, and the like. And when people like Hamilton responded saying, whoever said we could take it away? Well, why do we need an amendment saying Congress can't pass a law? We never said Congress could pass a law. Jefferson's answer was, say it. You've got to say it. You've got to be clear that this is something that cannot be tampered with. And through our history, while we've had ups and downs, and we've certainly had times when freedom of speech was under enormous pressure, including at the very beginning under John Adams with the Alien and Sedition Law, McCarthyism later on. There are lots of rough times. I think that in the last 30 or 40 years, we've made enormous progress in terms of taking an expansive view of the First Amendment, a very protective view of unpopular speech, for example, of minority speech. We are viewed in the world sometimes as sort of kooky because we allow so much speech. We're the only country that allows hate speech, protects hate speech. When President Carter signed a treaty, an international treaty on civil rights, which called on countries to take steps to ban hate speech, he signed it and he had to attach what's called a reservation saying, but of course all this is subject to the American Constitution, which means there are some things we just won't touch. And the reason, the core reason, is a distrust of the government as an entity which can control or direct or prohibit or punish speech.
Remind us of exactly what the
First Amendment says. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. As you'd expect, the Supreme Court has spent many years discussing, arguing, debating what abridging means, what the, quote, the freedom of speech means, and the like. But whatever the arguments, it's phrased very broadly, and it is interpreted very broadly.
And here is our first tweet from Michael, who says, while Citizens United might technically be a valid First Amendment law, it certainly violates the spirit of one person, one vote. How do you respond to that?
There's an inevitable tension between different parts of the Constitution and different social values, and we see it in Michael's very good question. The example I would cite, only as an example, is what was at issue in Citizens United itself. A group called Citizens United that was partially funded by corporate money that wanted to put a documentary on criticizing a candidate for the presidency. Now, in my view, that is so clearly forbidden by the First Amendment that at least as regards that entity, I could frankly never understand how my liberal friends could think that that could be banned, and how there were four members of the Supreme Court who signed on to the proposition that that could be criminal, not me.
Your chapter on Catherine McKinnon is one titled The First Amendment Under Fire from the Left. Tell us about Catherine McKinnon and what happened there.
Well, Professor Catherine McKinnon is one of the great scholars of what is women's rights in America, one of the people who's made, changed, affected the law in that area. And back sometime in the mid-80s, the New York Times asked Catherine McKinnon and myself to engage in a debate about the First Amendment chaired by the great Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Anthony Lewis. And the Times picked that title for it and ran it. It was a time when there were a lot of speech codes on campuses in which a lot of campuses were saying that you could be expelled for saying discomforting things about, among others, women, and in which there was an ongoing debate, much more than right now, about just how much, quote, freedom of speech, unquote, there should be on campus.
And the issue became also the question of whether pornography could be curbed.
Yes, and in particular, because Professor McKinnon had drafted a statute, which Indiana adopted, allowing for a legal claim to be made against groups or publishers of material which could be called pornographic. And the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, which includes Illinois, Indiana, and the like, said that it was unconstitutional, that sort of approach would allow a claim to be made with respect to some of the greatest works of literature in our history, that we can't put Ulysses in the dock. We can't put serious literature in the dock because it could be said to support the subordination of women, because the message of the book could be said to be so offensive that we ought not to allow it. And that court said, and I agreed, that we don't deal with bad thoughts by banning books or by allowing damages to be imposed because books or articles or the like were published. We do have a ban on obscenity, but we define it very narrowly. Anyone walking down the street can see that which is allowed in this country, including some very unsavory and disagreeable materials. That's the direction that the First Amendment has taken us, even as interpreted by some pretty conservative members of the court. We allow violence in films, for example. If Congress were to pass some sort of law about that, Quentin Tarantino's Academy Award, he won the Academy Award for this terribly violent film just last year. We protect that. And let me say, I understand we pay a price for doing that. Individuals who are the victims of very harsh things said about them pay a price. Our libel law we have, but it is less protective of individuals who've been falsely accused of various things than that in England, say. We do it because we are more concerned than they are about chilling speech, about allowing juries or judges to step into the role of being sort of quasi-censors. And in one area after another, we don't have absolute protection of speech, hardly ever. But we get pretty close to it sometimes. We make it so hard for someone to win some sorts of cases that effectively we have an almost anything-goes policy. For example, in America, a newspaper can publish an editorial criticizing a judge, saying the judge is incompetent, saying the judge ought to sentence someone to life imprisonment, that the judge ought to throw the book at so-and-so. In England, that's a contempt of court. You go to jail. People really go to jail. It's a democratic society. We don't have the only way to run a democratic society, but our way has come to be one of protecting free speech and free press and the like and other sorts of communication in a way which generally keeps the government away.
All right. Now, I'd like to ask you about the young man who has been in the front pages of the newspapers, an employee of Booz Allen, not a government employee, though the government has contracted with Booz Allen for the type of work this young man was doing, releasing to the Guardian newspaper and to the Washington Post secrets about information gathering by the U.S. government. What is your reaction to his actions? Is he acting out of free speech? Should he be prosecuted? Would you take his case if he were?
Look, based on what I've heard so far, he does seem more in the whistleblower mode than anyone doing anything just to profit or benefit himself or help a foreign country or anything like that. He is in enormous legal difficulties. There's no doubt of that. And I would not be surprised if the government can get him back in this country if he were charged with various violations of the Espionage Act for his conduct. Now, my view is that some of the revelations, particularly of the NSA collecting information about telephone calls made by all of us in this country to each other, not the text, not the voices, not the content, but the telephone numbers of who calls who, how long they spoke, and basically where they are because they have the area code. I think that that is a very, very serious, even dangerous risk to the Fourth Amendment, the right to be free of unreasonable search and seizure, and in a sense to the First Amendment as well. I don't disagree with the president at all on the proposition that you can't have 100% security and you can't have 100% privacy. And it's very hard for an outsider to pass on the national security side of the equation, how much this helps us, if it does, and in what circumstances it helps us. What I can say is that I think that allowing any branch of the government to have that sort of information about telephone calls made by all of us is a significant incursion into personal privacy.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. One last question on that before we open the phones. If that young man were to come to Floyd Abrams and ask Floyd Abrams to defend him on a pro bono basis, what would Floyd Abrams say?
Well, I hope my partners are not listening. I guess the first thing I'd say is he really needs a criminal lawyer. I mean, he's in terrible trouble.
He really
In terms of the criminal law, and he really needs...
Why is he in trouble in terms of criminal law?
Well, he's in trouble because he promised not to reveal classified information.
When he signed up.
Well, he signed, or even if there was no signature, the Supreme Court has said that the government has the power when they have secret information like this to impose limits on what someone can say.
Even if it's a contractual thing between the government and Booz Allen.
Right, but it's not just a contract. They could go after whatever money he makes. Probably not very much. We have an espionage law, very poorly drafted, from 1918.
But wouldn't he have to be spying for someone?
No, you don't have to, as we just saw with Bradley Manning. Private Manning pled guilty. He was well advised to charges of misuse of classified information. He could get 20 years for that. Now he's on trial for something worse than that now. the charge that they're proceeding against him is basically of trying, or in effect, being a part of helping an enemy of the United States. The theory being that by releasing the information
to
WikiLeaks, that he must have known that Al-Qaeda or other enemies could or would obtain the information.
But that's very different from what the young man at Booz Allen did.
Yes, it's different in some ways, but it's similar in some ways. The man at Booz Allen released top secret information about a previously undisclosed activity of the highest security nature.
Floyd Abrams, friend of the court, on the front lines with the First Amendment. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
We got 12 bottles of water, 56 beers, 2 vodkas, 4 whiskeys, 6 bottles of wine, tequila, Nutella, cheese, steaks, a Milky Way.
That's Seth Rogen in This Is the End, a parody of End of the World movies. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Rogen and Evan Goldberg, who co-wrote and co-directed the film and co-wrote Superbad. Join us.
And if you've just joined us, Floyd Abrams is with me. He's a leading attorney in First Amendment issues. His new book is titled Friend of the Court, On the Front Lines with the First Amendment, in which he talks about many of the cases in which he has been involved. I'm going to read you a tweet, Floyd Abrams, from Mark. He says, how is money speech, and does the First Amendment protect deceptive and outright untrue political ads?
First of all, I don't think money is speech, but without money, speech can't be disseminated in most situations to the public. So it facilitates, and in some cases, it's essential for speech to be heard. I think the second part of the question is really, really interesting and is not yet decided. Most First Amendment scholars, I think, would say that it's very dangerous to allow the government or the courts even or juries even to pass judgment on what's deceptive and what's not deceptive in the political realm, that the nature of politics is such that we shouldn't want limitations on speech about who to vote for based on a judgment as to what's deceptive or not. Now, it's true that a candidate could bring a libel case if the candidate is lied about in a campaign. The culture of this country has developed in a different direction. In England, the Queen brings libel suits. The Prime Minister goes to court and sues. Here it would be unthinkable for President Obama, whatever they say about him, to go to court. And candidates generally don't. For one thing, because we have built in so many protections for speakers that it's very hard to win if you're a public official and you bring a lawsuit. You basically have to prove not just that what was said wasn't true, but that the person that said it knew it wasn't true or suspected it wasn't true. My own view is that while we pay a price, and we do, for having a speech about political matters that is not just sort of badly thought out, foolish, or the like, but just wrong on the facts, that we don't want courts deciding that. The last part of this program in which people spoke about global warming seems to me an example. If a candidate got up and said things such as one of the speakers did, basically denying that global warming has all the bad effects that the other people on the panel thought, I wouldn't want a court deciding that. I just think that's for Congress, that's for the people, and so with political speech, I think it ought to be uninhibited and basically off limits. But as is always the case with the First Amendment, we pay a price for it. I mean, the price is people can say and then say 20 dozen times something that just isn't so.
All right, and now let's go to Elkhart, Indiana, and to Craig. Good morning to you, sir.
Yes, Diane, thank you very much for your show. I consider you a national treasure.
Thank you so much, sir.
Mr. Abrams already said something about whistleblowers, and I believe that this could set a chilling precedent for people who do find a reason to blow a whistle. If Senator Feinstein and Speaker Boehner, who seem to be able to compromise on the same idea of traitorship or seditious acts, I believe that he is correct. The same way I've been reading Joseph Stiglitz, The Price of Inequality, and Mr. Abrams and Mr. Stiglitz seem to agree that the Congress is to blame for much of this, and I'd just like to hear his thoughts.
And you're really regarding Citizens United, Floyd Abrams.
Well, first on the whistleblower's point, we do have a prescribed way for a whistleblower to file a complaint. And Mr. Snowden didn't do that. He went public. As I said earlier, I find it hard not to respect him for what appears to be his genuinely held views about what he came to learn and what seems like his willingness to pay the price for expressing him. The latter may not be true. I mean, if he does what Mr. Assange does and goes to the Ecuadorian embassy or something, that's no longer civil disobedience. But the notion of civil disobedience is, you know, saying something that's against the law and being willing to pay the price for it because of the principle of saying it. In terms of Professor Stiglitz, he does indeed argue that Congress is the entity to which we're supposed to turn for the resolution of issues such as economic inequality. And he's right.
All right, to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Susan.
Hi. Hi. To both of you. I just wanted to say I'm an active, passionate, volunteer voter registrar, League of Women Voters member, and the real outcome that Citizens United decision and the barrage of negative ads have had is a disenfranchisement of young and first-time voters. So if you look at these stakeholders whose lives will probably be most affected for the longest time anyway, and who feel generally that their vote doesn't matter, I respectfully would not want to bear the burden of this outcome from that decision. And I wonder how he does, knowing that this is accurate information.
Yeah. Well, first, I really don't view what you described as disenfranchisement at all. What you're saying is people have decided, chosen not to vote. And I would hope that, I'm sure that you do your best to persuade them to vote. Negative ads are not the result of Citizens United. Surely we've had negative ads throughout our history and in very recent years before Citizens United. And negative ads are an important part of American politics. I mean, there's nothing wrong, and certainly the First Amendment protects advertisements saying don't vote for so-and-so, don't trust so-and-so, get rid of President Obama, it's time for a change. It is, in my view, inconsistent with really a core notion of the First Amendment, but also of American political history, to treat negative ads as if they're off limits or they ought to be off limits in some way. I think they're part of the system. They play a role. Sometimes they help candidates. Sometimes they don't. That's up to the public.
Here's an email from Steve in Michigan, who says, today's guest says, Jefferson got it right in framing the First Amendment, and the Citizens United decision was correct. But at the time of its enactment, free speech was largely restricted to speaking at a town hall meeting, preaching from a soapbox, or issuing a primitive newspaper. There was no TV, radio, or internet in the 1780s. The First Amendment should not give the overly rich the right to flood the airwaves and internet with so much political rhetoric that it drowns out ordinary citizens.
I don't know what Jefferson would think about the development of new forms of communication. But I think he would think that we can't have the government limiting speech, whatever the form of communication. And that's the basis of my views as well.
Now, when you have a corporation that is deemed to have the same rights as an individual person, in your mind, what are the similarities between personhood and a corporation?
In my view, the First Amendment protects speech, not speakers, and we don't distinguish in general based on who's speaking in terms of the First Amendment rights. I mean, I spent most of my life representing corporations that I suspect most of your listeners and participants in this conversation would think deserve First Amendment. Newspapers, broadcasters, museums, I don't know, but I would find it hard to believe that where I'm sitting now is not paid for by a corporation. Most entities that engage in public speaking or advocacy take a corporate form. Now, most of them that we think of are, quote, the press. Again, newspapers, broadcasters, and the like, they're corporations. So we really shouldn't, I think, start down the road of saying that because a corporation is doing the speaking, that therefore we really got to be careful about allowing it. That would sweep in all the corporations. And if you want to try to limit it to certain types of corporations, then I think that's another problem of its own. So from my perspective, the problem is not that corporations speak. The problem is sometimes what they say is unpalatable to us, and sometimes too many of them aren't acting as public citizens the way we'd like.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's a tweet. How does your guest define press regarding freedom of the press? Where is the line, if any, between traditional press, bloggers, tweeters, etc.?
A great question. I think at the end of the day, we can't distinguish except on the basis of function. What role does someone play? What role does an institution play or not? I've had this come up frequently representing journalists in which I've urged upon courts that the First Amendment ought to allow them not to reveal sources. And the next question I got is, what about a blogger? It seems to me the only answer, I'll put it this way, the answer can't be that you've got to be a newspaper, for profit, etc. It just can't be that because you're cutting out too many speakers. I think the answer has got to be people who gather information for dissemination to the public, in effect, people who behave like journalists, have got to get the same protection as journalists.
All right, and just one point of clarification I wanted to make. This particular station is funded 50% by its listeners, by listener contributions, and the rest do come from many businesses and even corporations. Just want to make that point. Let's go here to Pittsboro, North Carolina, and to Aaron. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been enjoying listening to the show. I had a couple of questions.
Be quick, please.
I've been reading the comments on the website, and there's one guy who said something really interesting. Paraphrase, money is not speech, it's volume control. But the main reason I called was I'm wondering if he has an opinion on Snowden. My personal opinion, this is the guy who leaked the wiretapping program, which seems to be peripherally related to his book. And personally, I feel the guy deserves a medal, not prosecution. This is a blatant violation of the Fourth Amendment. I mean, despite the fact they got a court order, they did not have probable cause.
All right. Thanks for your call.
You know, I think that the courts have gone wrong with respect to the Fourth Amendment. There was a decision back in 1979 which basically said, by a 5-3 vote, that there is no really reasonable expectation of privacy by people who use the telephone, since they understand that the telephone company has the records, and therefore they don't expect those records to be kept private. I think that was just wrong. That is the law right now. But I think it was wrong. I hope if any of these cases come up involving Mr. Snowden or anyone else, that the lawyer who's doing the case tries to revisit that. Because I think there is a reasonable expectation of privacy, not just that you won't be overheard, which the Supreme Court has said, but that who you are, what your phone number is, where you live, how long you spoke, would be kept private unless some judge enters an order to the contrary.
I have the feeling, whether criminal or not, you may be hearing from Mr. Snowden. Floyd Abrams, his new book is titled Friend of the Court, On the Front Lines with the First Amendment. I was so glad to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.